Lowe's knows you've got a job to do, and we help get it done. With the MyLowe's Pro Rewards program, eligible members save more. With volume discounts on qualifying orders through a quote of $2,000 or more. Join for free today. Lowe's, we help you save. Offer can't be combined with any other discount, contract, and or special pricing. Exclusions, more terms, and restrictions apply. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
Quarantine by George O. Smith. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Quarantine by George O. Smith. Read by Quartertone. Chapter 1. Temp Alloy. Tony Morrell looked around the bench for a piece of brass and found a proper-sized chunk handy. That saved him a trip to the stockroom. He chucked it up in a vise, picked up a file, and set the teeth of the file against a chunk of brass to shape it. He pushed. The file slid across the bit of brass as though there were no teeth. The end of the file went past without resistance, and the vise jaws took a chunk of skin off Tony's knuckles. He made an appropriate and unprintable comment, inspected the file curiously, and tried again, but with restraint. This time he skinned another knuckle, but not so badly. He tried another file, and even more restraint. The result was the same. The file skidded across the bit of brass without touching it. It was like Tony Morrell remembered his first day in the machine shop as a kid. Like trying to file a wrist pin. He picked up a center punch and a hammer. He set the punch against the brass and belted the top a good whack with the hammer. The top fudged over a bit. That was intentionally soft. The point blunted. That was intentionally hard. The brass did not even show a bright spot beneath the point of contact. He tried a hacksaw with a new blade. No result. Swearing, Tony Morrell took the bit of brass and placed it between the jaws of a power shears. He pressed the button, and the shears came down, hard. The knife shattered. A huge chip sprang out of the cutting edge where it struck the bit of brass. The heavy motor ground to a shuddering halt, and the frame of the shears gave slightly.
"Murder," he breathed.
Andy Cleave was watching this from the other side of his lathe.
"What have you got there, Tony?" he asked.
Tony shook his head.
"Brass,"
he said doubtfully. Andy grunted. If that bit had been brass, any of Tony's machinations would have been successful. Nothing could touch the bit of metal, ergo it could not be brass. Andy looked on, permissibly forgetting his lathe. The tool had run out beyond the work, coming inexorably toward the four-jawed chuck. Finally, it touched. The jaw came around as the tool moved to the left, and the area of contact was less than 5/1000ths of an inch. Normally, this would have produced a cut on the jaw of the chuck and a hoot of derision from any machinist who saw another scar lathe chuck. But the scant contact stopped the lathe. There was a foul screech from the series of belts that turned the lathe. The back gears complained. The motor grunted once and stalled. The lights went dim until a fuse blew, taking the power off the stalled motor. Andy looked at the hung-up chuck and saw the scant interference that had stopped the lathe.
"I've got it, too," he said in an awed voice. "Something has made this chuck harder than a pawnbroker's heart."
Andy Cleave and Tony Morrell headed for the front office on a dead run. James Green held a match for the girl's cigarette, then applied the flame to his briar. He leaned back with a puzzled smile and started to tell the girl what he knew.
"I think we may have it licked," he said. "We'll know later."
Leona Holden smiled graciously.
"I hope so," she told him, "though I know all too little of this sort of thing. Dad talks as though everybody knows all the answers, leaving out far too much of the uninteresting detail that tells the history of the thing. Mind going over the minutiae?"
"Not at all," said Jim. "You know what temp alloy is?"
"A hard alloy, isn't it?"
"Temp alloy is more than that. Temp alloy is, so far anyway, the ultimate in hard alloys. It is practical only because of its hardness characteristic. Temp alloy, when first processed, is about as soft as mild steel. With time, it grows very hard, 1,000 times harder than tungsten carbide. That's due to the radioactivity.
Radioactivity? Asked Leona Holden. I'm more puzzled now than before.
Temp alloy is an alloy composed mainly of chromium and cobalt. The remainder consists of two of the transuranic radioisotopes that are manufactured in the uranium pile. Alloying the stuff cold, a physicist's word for non-radioactive, results in an alloy metal that one can touch with any tool. We mix it with a metal, not the right one, but one which is radioactive. Then the radioactivity causes the transmutation of the element into the one we want. In other words, the original alloy is soft, but the emission of the radioactive particle causes the alloying element to change so that it is a hard alloy. Follow?
Vaguely, answered the girl with a slight smile.
Well, temp alloy starts off soft and hardens swiftly in a matter of about 8 hours. The trouble is, Miss Holden, that temp alloy, as a fabricated material, for a gear, it is made in a blank and machined into the final product, is fine, but it must be worked before it grows hard. Now, it is almost impossible to come out even, and there is either a huge wastage because the machinists run out of material before their workday is over and then can loaf the rest of the day, or the temp alloy stockpile is too great, and when the workmen are finished, there is still a quantity left that will harden and become waste. Understand?
But surely that cannot be great, objected the girl.
Not for any one day, agreed Jim. But take it for 6 months, then it becomes a problem. Also, what to do with the scrap? Nice paperweights, anchors, or something to crack nuts on? Anyway, he said with a grin, it is important enough for your father to award Green Metallurgical Laboratory a contract to develop an alloy that will cut temp alloy.
And you think you have it?
We have a very strange alloy, but I'm not too sure of it, said Green. And you can tell your father that. You see, we discovered an alloy that was the reverse of temp alloy. It starts off very hard, hard enough to cut temp alloy, but softens with time. Takes about 8 hours. Now, that might be fine, but there is atomic interaction between tool and work as it is used to cut temp alloy. We give it a name, Miss Holden, and call it Fool's Alloy. We found that when it is used, everything goes to pieces.
Just how?
Well, temp alloy approaches a stable hardness when left alone, just as fool's alloy approaches a stable softness. These curves are exponential curves. But when fool's alloy is used to cut temp alloy, the fool's alloy goes dead soft in about a half hour, and the temp alloy starts to harden linearly, even though it has been in a stable state of hardness for months.
But how can that be?
We're not too certain. But remember, every time you cut anything, even butter with a knife, you leave some of the tool on the work and some of the work on the tool. And it takes only a few 0.001% of element 97 to make temp alloy what it is. Ergo, a minute quantity of the important part of fool's alloy is all that is needed to make the temp alloy get much harder. Leona Holden nodded brightly.
But look, she said, wouldn't using the super hard temp alloy serve as a tool edge for cutting normal temp alloy?
Yes, for a time, admitted Green. But the trouble is, Miss Holden, that the hardness creep passes from the super hard temp alloy tool to the normal temp alloy work, and eventually the work is too hard to cut again. There is... The door opened violently, and Tony Morrow and Andrew Cleave came in on the dead run and skidded to a stop as they saw the girl. What's up? Asked Green.
Tony dropped the piece of brass on Jim's desk.
This is supposed to be brass, he said. And it is harder than the hinges of Hades. You can't cut it with a file. I wrecked the shear blade, and when I tried it on the stone, it made an excellent grinding wheel dresser.
Brass?
Unless someone has regained the secret of hard copper, said Tony Morrow uncertainly.
Leona Holden looked interested.
They claim there was such a secret, she observed.
Jim Green laughed.
Nope, he said. It wasn't that, but just part of the search for a harder edge that has gone on for 20,000 years.
20,000 years?
Green nodded.
It started when Cain slew Abel and discovered that a hunk of flint was harder than a human skull. The next man wore a leather helmet. That was fine until someone discovered bronze which cut leather. Alexander carved himself an empire with bronze swords. Then someone got some carbon mixed with iron, and the age of chivalry was heralded in on the clangor of mild steel. The bronze sword turned its edge against the steel armor. The old-timers immediately claimed that their fathers had bronze swords that would cut anything, that these modern bronze swords weren't as hard as in the good old days. They forgot to mention that in the good old days, the ability to cut anything could not possibly have included the new alloy, steel. Well, people have been hunting for newer and harder alloys ever since.
I see, she admitted uncertainly. But this piece of brass?
I hope you'll pardon me, said Jim, but we've got work to do. There's something afoot that is far from good. Tell your father I'll let him know in a few days whether we can stabilize the superhard temp alloy.
I'll be back in a few days, she said. I'm interested enough to want to watch this.
Chapter 2. Contagion. According to law, any building that housed a self-reacting nuclear pile employing uranium or any other fissionable material must be not less than 10 miles from the nearest dwelling. Green Metallurgical Laboratory was, therefore, 10 miles, by the best surveyor that the state of Indiana could supply, away from the outward corner of the last house in Ramble, Indiana. Green Metals was connected to civilization by means of a road made of metal alloy paving locks, a third rail interurban trolley line that took workers to and from, a railroad spur, and a series of tall towers that carried high tension lines. The lines were used to carry power to three outlying cities. The power generated by the uranium pile was a byproduct. It was used to generate the radioisotopes and transuranic elements used to make special alloys for special jobs, at a very special price. It was along the metal-surfaced road that Leona Holden drove her 16-cylinder Holden Special back to Ramble. Her story was none too clear. Yet she conveyed to Gregory Holden the one fact that somehow, strangely, Green Metals had discovered a means of making any metal super hard, whereupon Gregory Holden called in his legal staff. Dean Mars heard the tale again, produced the Holden contract with Green Metals, and ran through it with a practiced eye. He had written the contract himself, and he knew where to find what he was looking after. He nodded with self-satisfaction.
"Go on," beamed Holden. "How does it tie in?"
"It states in effect that any developments made under this contract shall belong completely to the Holden Enterprises," he said. "Now, it is a fact that Green was attempting to find an alloy capable of cutting temp alloy. Therefore, if, due to byproduct of this search, any other discoveries of a valuable nature are made, they shall also become the property of Holden Enterprises."
Gregory Holden selected a large cigar and lit it with a flourish.
"If what my daughter says is true," he observed, "I can see automobiles with super hard bodies. We'll give Green a week, then we'll close in."
Leona looked puzzled.
"Will that be necessary?" she asked. "Mr. Green seems to be an honest man."
Her father looked tolerantly at her.
"My dear," he said, "when something like this is in the wind, no man is too honest. Green will be inspecting this contract with a microscope to see if there are any flaws that will permit him to keep his discovery."
"Well, I don't believe that of Jim Green."
"I do, and will prove it to you."
Leona left the office. She did not think it of Jim Green, but there was no sense in arguing with her father on the subject. As she left, Dean Mars looked up.
"Can you squeeze him?" he asked.
"I think so," replied Holden. "Temp alloy is a Holden product, you know, and you should know."
Mars nodded complacently. Then he said,
"Green has Tony Morrow working for him, you know."
"Morrow is a has-been," replied Holden roughly. "All he can do is to stand in the way and make nasty remarks."
"I'm inclined to worry about Morrow. When he was head of the Morrow Alloy Company, he was no man's fool, as you very well know."
"He was our man's fool, though perhaps no other man's," laughed Holden. "He developed temp alloy, and it was you that convinced the judge and jury that his act of shipping us the hard metal was a cover-up."
"That wasn't too hard," smiled Morris. "All I did was to show them that the cost seemed too high, after which I used Morrow's own figures to show that temp alloy was as easy to shape as mild steel.
They assumed themselves that Morrow was shaping the stuff soft and charging us for the job of shaping the hard stuff. The kicker in the contract was the thing that gave us Morrow alloys, and that's what put Tony Morrow out of a job.
Well, find a kicker in the green contract.
No kicker is needed. When and if it's needed, we've got Green where we want him. I wonder if there's any truth in this thing at all. It seems outrageous that a hardness factor could creep from metal to metal like that.
Well, we'll find out, said Holden, relighting his cigar. And maybe we'll own Jim Green by his soul, too. Fact is, continued Holden after a moment of thought, I'd prefer that he does try to weasel out of it. Then we can really move in.
Jim Green nodded at the electronics specialist.
Sure, I've got a moment. What is it?
Super-hard temp alloy is a superconductor.
Superconductor? Are you sure? I've never heard of one existing at normal temperatures.
Edwin Wright produced figures and a multi-curve graph.
These curves show the hardness creep of the super-hard stuff, he said, pointing to one of two, versus normal temp alloy. You'll notice that the super-hard curve is incomplete but extrapolated. The specific resistivity of both are shown, too, and that's how I extrapolated the hardness curve. There is a definite mathematical relationship between the hardness of temp alloy and its ohmic resistance. Therefore, when the super-hard stuff starts to get beyond the range of our high-test Rockwell machines, I took the liberty of making the mathematical extrapolation. It approaches a perfect conductor. It is also non-magnetic, which hasn't changed. Its heat conductivity is something terrific, too, like liquid helium. I can see the development of high-wattage microwave generators out of it. You can make the tube elements very small, and the radiating fins large and out of the circuit, so long as you connect them with temp alloy. Then, any heat generated in the elements themselves will also be communicated instantly to the fins. I've tried it with a long filament of this stuff. You take a temp alloy rod about 6 feet long and 20 thousandths in diameter, and hit one end with an oxyhydrogen flame. It gets white hot all along the wire at the same time, and you can cool the whole thing by sticking the far end in water. When you dangle one end in water and heat the other end with a torch, it's just like pointing the torch itself in the water.
Oh, that's some metal, then. Well, Wright, you go to work on it and see what you can do.
Ed Wright nodded.
I'm working with Otto.
Green nodded. Otto was the theorist, the mathematician, the abstract thinker. Confronted by facts, Otto Lindstrom had an untrammeled mind with unlimited imagination. He had, however, no use for fiction. His world discounted any fiction until it became fact. Otto Lindstrom and Ed Wright made a good pair, for Ed was inclined to take any situation or sets of facts and extend them a bit beyond the fact so that he could build a fantasy about them. While Jim Green was considering this, the telephone rang, and he reached idly for it.
"Mr. Green, this is Joe down in the cafeteria. I thought you'd like to know that we're having trouble opening the cans."
"Hold it," said Jim, wondering. "I'll be right down."
He went at once. Joe handed Green a can and indicated the can opener on the wall. Jim Green slid the can under the knife and tried to clamp the handle down. It would not go, but stuck just as contact was made. That told Green volumes. He called Tony Morrow and Andrew Cleave and three other workmen and set them to checking the metal building with center punches and hammers. Within an hour, he knew all he needed to know. It had started with the lathe upon which the test cutting of the first temp alloy by the first fool's alloy had been done. Now it was spreading through the building. As he returned to his office, one of the girls called his attention to the fact that her stapling machine no longer worked. The staples came out, and they punctured the paper, but they did not fold over on the underside. Tony Morrow, tapping on the floor, lost his balance and fell against the stenographer's desk. The typewriter toppled, and the girl wasted no time in fading back out of the way. The typewriter hit the metal floor with a crash, and bounced unharmed.
"Now," muttered Green, "if we could control this, we'd have that glorious post-war world."
An hour later, Jim Green had every member of the plant assembled. He told them what was going on. Then he concluded,
"This must be stopped. You all can see the result if it is not. Contamination by a piece of treated metal will spread indefinitely, so far as we know. It takes but a minute contact. Now, we cannot be responsible for the death of this civilization, and that is what it amounts to. Those of you who prefer to stay may do so. Those of you who prefer to leave may do so, providing you leave with absolutely no metal on you. All production work is suspended. All facilities will be put on the job of figuring out how to confine and control this contagion of metals. When we have it licked, we'll see to it that all of you are repaid for your discomfort. Okay?
There was an uncertain roar that greeted this, but the result was gratifying. Chapter 3. Countermove. It was midnight when the special train came down the siding. It was laden with canned goods in jars and other foodstuffs packaged without metal. The men set to work with a will to remove a certain quantity, but the bulk of the stuff in the mechanical refrigerator cars seemed to be ignored. The engineer and train crew broached the subject to Jim Green.
"I am impounding the train," he said.
"You can't!"
"I am. It is necessary."
He explained the hardening of metals, and then said,
"Can you understand the decline of civilization that would take place if no metal could be worked? We had to order supplies because we couldn't open a tin can. We've unsealed your cars only because we couldn't break the metal seal once it got super hard. We've had to open all candies and other stuff wrapped with tinfoil because super hard tinfoil cannot even be bent. Every watch in the place has stopped because the hairspring has such a violent strength that there is not enough energy to flex it."
The engineer thought for a moment.
"How about the tracks?" he asked.
"It's creeping along them, too. We're cutting them. Right now."
The engineer looked at the brakeman.
"We're stuck," he said. "Let's help."
At the edge of the plant yard, just inside the metal fence, a workman was plying an acetylene torch. Another man was sitting astride the rail, tapping it with a center punch.
"Better hurry, Tim,"
he said, moving along a few inches. He tapped again, nodded, and kept trying the rail. 3 minutes later, he muttered something and moved again. The hardness was creeping along the rails swiftly. In fact, behind him, Otto Lindstrom was making calculations as he moved. Lindstrom turned to Jim Green as the latter arrived and said,
"The hardness is creeping swifter now. It is accelerating rapidly. Unless the man with the torch hurries, he will not be quick enough."
The man testing the rails moved again.
"Better give up, Tim," he said.
Tim grunted and watched the rail for a moment before shaking his head. He applied the torch again, and the sparks flew.
"I can't beat it, Larry," he said confidently.
Then, as he spoke, the sparks died from the rail, and Larry leaped from his seat with a cry of pain. The hardening creep had reached the cut before Tim was finished, and the heat had swept along the rails, burning Larry.
"Look," said Green, "calculate how far it travels before you can cut in, and go out and do it without test. Darn it, Larry, you've got a contaminated punch there that's helping the spread along."
A roar of sound and a belch of flame came from 500 feet away. Green's men had just cut the metal surface roadway with dynamite. Gregory Holden snorted angrily and flung the telephone back at its rest.
"No communication," he said. "That means that Green has something."
"Trouble, perhaps," said Leona. "Something must have happened."
"You're darn well right it happened,"
scowled Holden.
"What happened was that Green did turn up with a means of hardening metal. Now he's hiding behind a wall of secrecy until he can figure out an angle."
"I don't believe it."
"Maybe not," grunted Holden, "but you can bet it's true. He... Yes, Alice?"
"A Mr. Morrow to see you," his secretary told him.
"Morrow? Well, by all means, send him in. Tony Morrow, Leona. Green must think I'm guileless, or he must be stupid. He should know that sending Tony Morrow with any cock-and-bull story wouldn't convince me of anything. Hello, Morrow. What's going on out at your place?"
"It's bad," said Tony, "and quite dangerous."
Holden tossed a quick, "What did I tell you?" glance at Leona, and then selected a cigar from his humidor.
"Tell me," said Holden leisurely, "did Jim Green really discover a way to harden all metals?"
"In a sense, yes."
And what does he intend to do with it?
Try to keep it safe until we can figure out how to handle it.
Morrow didn't know, of course, that he was almost echoing Holden's previous words. Morrow disliked Holden immensely and would have given years of his life for a chance to get back at the tycoon. Regardless of the opinions of jurors and judges who were misled by brilliant oratory glibly describing the machinations of a technically complex process, it was a fact that Holden's grab of the Morrow Alloy Company was more than 60% cold-blooded steel.
Tell me, Morrow, why did you come here?
Because Jim wanted you to understand. You see, Jim Green is quite a reasonable person, Holden, far more honest than either you or myself. He knew you would expect his answer when he said he'd have one. Therefore, I am here to explain.
I see. And Jim Green hopes to keep this affair a secret?
Hardly a secret. That, I fear, is impossible. But at least we can keep the terrible truth out of the public hands until it is safe.
Terrible truth, huh?
asked Holden.
Morrow grinned. You can have your hard metal, Holden, so soon as it is not dangerous to society.
Meaning what?
Meaning the so-called nuclear safety clause that is included in each and every contract dealing with any product or byproduct of the uranium pile. If it is not baldly stated in the contract, it is still in force by Act of Congress as of 1948.
Just what is this danger?
Asked Holden. We cut the telephone lines, the high wires, and the railroad to prevent the spread of metal hardness, said Tony. Likewise, we blasted the metal-surfaced road. We're impounding all incoming metal, whether it be automobile, railroad, or belt buckle.
And you have not a stitch of metal on you?
Morrow laughed. An excellent tribute to my dental equipment, he said, but I state proudly that there is not the trace of a filling in any of my teeth. I happen to be the only living soul at Green Metals that can step outside the fence without contaminating the rest of the world.
Yeah, drawled Holden. How about the earth?
This is Indiana. We're situated on a bed of Indiana limestone surrounded by a sea of alluvial sand and moraine, and there isn't a pocket of natural raw material within a good many miles of us.
You actually claim that this hardening follows all metal?
We had trouble cutting the railroad tracks, said Morrow. We had to abandon our cut 3 times before we got it cut through. Each time the hardening raced along the tracks and caught up with the torchbearer.
Rather hard to believe, said Holden.
Morrow smiled slightly. Inwardly, he was bubbling. Often he had heard it said that there is nothing so subject to doubt as the absolute truth. He had a fair idea that Holden was suspicious of any statements from Green, especially any coming through himself as spokesman. Putting himself in Holden's position, Morrow could see Holden's supposition that Green had made a monumental discovery, and that Green was trying to employ the nuclear safety clause to suppress the discovery until he could develop some means of handling it himself. If Holden were really convinced of this, he would act. If he managed somehow to acquire a sample, the fat would really be in the fire. Morrow had a good witness to testify that he had warned Holden, and the chances were that Holden had this conversation recorded anyway. So Morrow was sticking to the truth.
"What does Green hope to do with all this?"
asked Holden. "If it can be worked out, everything will be all right," replied Tony, picking his phrases carefully. "If not, Green will call in the government."
"Government?"
"The resources of the United States government are large enough to find the answer to this new feature. Excepting that Jim is afraid of it, we'd already be calling it the Green Effect." To Holden, visualizing the ramifications of a super-hard metal, the word government meant armed forces. The Navy would leap gleefully to accept armor plates that could not be touched with anything up to and including oxyhydrogen. The Army would take it as quickly. And if it meant anything at all, the skies would be filled with super-hard dural, magnesium, and aluminum metals. That was not too good. If Green offered it to the Navy, they would accept it as a sideline issue from the original contract, and Holden would lose. Holden might appeal to the courts, but if he did so, he would be condemned as one who would obstruct the security of the nation. Also, if Green did give it to the armed forces, Holden might consider the process a military secret. If that happened, he would not be permitted to speak himself.
Okay,
he said quietly.
You tell Green that so soon as he figures out which angle to follow, we'll get together and work something out.
I'll tell him that, Morrow said thoughtfully. Tony Morrow left, wondering just what course Holden would take. Also, how long it would be. Chapter 4. Atom Bomb. The car that drove up to the breach in Jim's Metal Road paused only long enough for the driver to throw in the front drive gears. Then it proceeded across the rough spot. It drove up to the front door and uniformed men got out, looked around, and then entered boldly, ignoring the weak protests of the guards at the portal. The leader identified himself to Jim Green.
I am Major General Langley.
Yes, General Langley. I'm sorry you came, at least so far in.
Langley waved away the concern and came to the point of his visit.
I'm given to understand that you have a process of making a super-hard metal here.
We have, but it is not that simple.
Why?
Because the process is in violation of the nuclear safety clause. It is not safe to permit its use in civilized places.
The general nodded easily.
We of the armed forces operate under the calculated risk in times of possible danger. Fact of the matter is, a bomber crew with a full load flying over friendly territory is operating under calculated risk, because anybody who handles dangerous explosives does.
This is not a matter of personal risk, objected Green.
No?
It may mean the death of civilization itself.
Come, come, Mr. Green. That's what they said about the atom bomb. That's what someone probably said about the bow and arrow.
May I ask who put you on this trail?
General Langley nodded.
Gregory Holden, he said. As he explained it to me, you are holding secret one of his processes.
In a sense, we are, admitted Green. But Holden should be aware of the possibilities of this. I sent Tony Morrow in to tell him everything.
I was told there would be talk of danger, said the general quietly.
Well, there is danger, snapped Green.
Perhaps I should insist that the Armed Forces Laboratories investigate. I'll ask you for a sample of your hard metal.
Green stood up and banged the desk with a hard fist.
No metal is leaving this plant, not even your car.
Come now, Green. You cannot impound army equipment.
No, it will not leave.
May I point out that my men are armed?
I'll ask you to have one armed man sent up here, said Green quietly. But tell me, meanwhile, just what did Holden tell you?
The general looked at Green in puzzlement. He went to the window and called one of the armed soldiers before answering Jim's question.
Holden says this hardening process is rightfully his by virtue of a legal contract. According to Holden, the value of this process is such that you would go to any lengths to void the contract, even to the point of offering it to the armed forces. However, Holden offered it to us first.
Holden, then, is using the United States Army to pull what he thinks is a chestnut out of the fire, said Green bitterly. The fool!
General Langley grunted.
Holden knows that the Army will deal properly with those who help it. You are hindering, Green. Had you made the offer, we would have dealt with you.
Green was shaking his head when the soldier came in.
General, I'm going to demonstrate to you my super-hard alloy, and then it's danger. May I ask your permission to direct the soldier?
Corporal Hadley, this is James Green. He has my permission.
Yes, sir.
Hadley, said Green, fix your bayonet and lunge through that window screen over there.
The corporal looked at Green as though the man were crazy. Shaking his head, Hadley fixed his bayonet and made a dilatory poke at the screen. The screen stopped the bayonet and did not even bend. Hadley rammed it hard, but the heavy rifle stopped cold. Putting his entire weight and muscle into it, Hadley stabbed at the screen and nearly lost his footing due to the complete and solid stoppage.
You'll notice that the screen is not even deformed, said Green. Now quickly, soldier, fire a shot at the screen.
Hadley raised his rifle and fired. The bullet hit the screen and would have ricocheted save for the screen itself. The cupronickel jacket of the bullet parted under the fine wire mesh and strained or extruded itself through by almost a 1/16 of an inch. It hung there, hot.
When that cools down, said Green, you'll find a crisscross thread on the bullet. Now, Hadley, I think it is time to fire once more.
The soldier pulled the trigger. There was a sharp click, but no report. The soldier recocked his rifle and tried again. Then he levered the shell from the chamber and tried another. That, too, misfired. Green picked up the outcast shell and handed it to General Langley.
Note the primer, he said to the general. The spread of this metal contagion is so swift that by now the corporal's rifle has become hardened from its contact against the screen. Obviously, the metal primer cannot be dented to fire the shell.
We could put a plastic primer in, said Langley.
And kill your own soldiers?
How? Snapped the general angrily. I doubt that you have the experience in firearms.
Green held up a hand.
When a shell is fired, it expands slightly. The holding furrow widens to permit the bullet to leave. The bullet is deformed as it hits the rifling lands of the barrel. With super-hardened metal, General Langley, the shell would not expand, the holding furrow would not permit the exit of the bullet, and if it did, the bullet would stop when it hit the rifling lands. The net result, in any case, is the fact that the exploding gases can only escape back through the primer hole, fighting their way through the gas closures, and finally ending up by hitting the soldier in the face.
Green smiled.
Of course, he said with the tolerant air of a man speaking to a child, you could design a rifle so that the escaping gases would blow out easily.
The corporal blinked.
Why, he said, this makes all rifles obsolete.
He thought for a moment.
In fact, all firearms. We're back to the knife.
Green turned to the general.
And if you want your army to be equipped with this super hard metal, do it quickly, General Langley. Because once all metal on Earth gets hard, you won't be able to machine any of it.
Leona Holden bumped across the breach in the road and ran to Jim Green's office, but found him missing. The girl in the front of the office enclosure idly pointed out at the back door that led from the office room to the laboratory, and Leona went there. She found Jim Green working over an analytical balance, measuring powders of metals.
Leona, he said. You shouldn't have come here.
I had to find out, she said simply.
Find out?
The truth of this. Dad says you're trying to steal his process. Tell me honestly, Jim, what is it?
What Tony Morrow told you is the truth, he said.
But what are you doing?
Jim laughed bitterly.
The obvious, he said. Whatever nuclear reaction caused this all-embracing total hardening of all metals, it was started by the contact of two radioactive alloys. We know why each of the alloys behaved as they did alone, but not why they should have touched off this contagious metal disease. Therefore, I am trying to develop another alloy that will reverse the process.
Then it is bad, breathed the girl. I'm glad.
Glad? Exploded Green.
Not glad for the trouble, of course, she said quietly and sincerely. But definitely glad that my father is wrong. But, Jim, just how bad is it?
General Langley came from the window and faced the girl.
Miss Holden, he said, it is bad enough to convince me that I must stay here because of the silver fillings in my teeth. Until Green gets his answer, we are stuck.
And what are your chances? Asked Leona.
I don't know. This looks like a hopeless case. We don't know what to look for in the first place, and the permutations possible in making alloys out of 100-odd elements are approaching infinity. Hey, that's a plane!
General Langley turned to the corporal, who was sitting near the portable radio removed from the general's command car.
Contact them, he said.
Yes, sir.
The pilot called and was answered.
This is General Langley. What are you doing here?
Major Howes to General Langley. Your report by radio as of this morning has been considered by the Master Board of Strategy. It has been declared a first-class national emergency. We have orders for you to evacuate the premises.
Don't be ridiculous. We can't.
You must. I have orders to destroy the plant.
Destroy it? Snapped the general. You must not, and that is an official order from me.
You outrank me, sir, came the reply. However, I am under formal order from the President of the United States and responsible only to him. You are also. You are to evacuate the premises.
We cannot.
Why?
because we carry with us the contaminated metal. There is no man or woman present who has a silver filling in his teeth that does not stand an excellent possibility of being contaminated.
Then, if you leave, you may cause the spread of this contagion?
Precisely.
Then hold on a moment. I must contact my superiors.
Minutes passed. Then Major Howes returned to the radio contact. His voice was very strained.
Since you are all contaminated, he said, I have orders to destroy you all. This is a matter of sacrificing you for the benefit of humanity.
Can't you give us time to work this out? Demanded the general.
The National Board of Strategy fears that the contamination may spread if it is not taken care of instantly.
The major's voice broke again as he said,
I'm sorry, sir, but I have orders.
Green whirled from the window.
What's he doing? He just dropped something.
A-bomb, grunted the general. To destroy us and save civ-
No!
Screamed Green. The general faced Green sarcastically.
You're not afraid to die, are you?
He asked bitterly.
No, said Green, but I am against dying for no good. Look, General, if the Eastman Kodak people had trouble with straw paper made from a field in Illinois that was contaminated by the explosion at Los Alamos, what chance do you think there is that this will really be destroyed?
The General blinked, and at that moment the bomb landed on the ground below.
Time fused! Yelled the General.
We have one chance! Cried Green.
He unsnapped the catches on the window screen with one hand and grabbed a handful of small super-hard tempalloy samples with the other. Then he leapt out the window, raced to the pit where the bomb lay ticking, and liberally sprinkled the monstrous bomb with the contaminating metal. Then he ran back to meet the others who were coming through the door.
Get away!
He screamed at them.
If it works, said the general, we'll not need distance. If it doesn't, we can't run that far anyway.
There was a sharp cracking report as the internal gun fired non-critical masses of plutonium together and fused them into a supercritical mass, followed by a hard roar as fission took place and the expanding energy filled the cavities in the bomb. Trapped, the mad energy roared in confinement and dissipated as heat. The bomb, hidden by its own pit, flared incandescent instantly, blasted a solid fan-wise beam of light into the sky that paled the sun and then sank out of sight as it melted the very ground beneath it. Sand, dirt, and rock flowed into the bubbling pit and were hurled into the sky in a mad geyser. The ground grew hot beneath their feet and the molten pit spread wider, its edges eroding into a bubbling mass. The spot in the center above the bomb gurgled and hurled spouts of molten earth into the air. Jim Green shook his head and mopped his brow.
I am beat, he said weakly.
General Langley was still staring at the molten pit.
Licked,
he gritted. And those who heard him knew he meant the atomic bomb. He turned to Green and said,
Jim, this is an order. Lick this hardening disease somehow, but keep it handy.
Then he turned to the still increasing puddle of molten earth and muttered,
'Tis truly an ill wind that blows no good.
Chapter 5. Cost Plus. Gregory Holden stopped his big car at the metal gate. Puzzled, he leaned out of the car and snapped,
I'm Gregory Holden, soldier. I want in.
Mister, said the soldier, snapping the bolt on his rifle. I don't care if you are Geronimo himself. No one goes in without General Langley's permission.
What's going on here, anyway?
The soldier smiled. No man who goes in can come out. That's why we're restricting the clientele to the cream of society. We want no overcrowding.
Don't be insolent. Tell Langley I want in.
Don't be hasty. General Langley is in command, and he is a busy man.
I'll enter anyway. I'm Gregory Holden.
You enter without permission, and that name will look well on your tombstone, gritted the soldier. Now be a good corpse, intended, and I'll see if you have the proper qualifications for entry.
Fuming in rage, Holden respected the rifle of the sentry and of the other guards that ringed the premises. He waited for a full half hour before the guard returned and opened the gate.
Walk, he said.
That's a full half mile, objected Holden.
It'll take some of that pot off of you, suggested the soldier. No metal goes in that can't be stopped.
Remove all coins, belt buckles, fountain pens, keys, and everything else of metal, and you may enter. As soon as you're clean, we'll know it by the induction balance here.
Fuming, Gregory Holden removed metal bits. He was amazed to find out just how many bits of hard metal he carried. As he started down the road, the officer smiled at him.
"Lucky you're wearing trousers with buttons instead of a zipper," he called. "One guy went in wearing 7-striped shorts."
Holden grunted angrily. When he reached the laboratory, he snapped,
"What's going on here?"
Langley turned.
"We are keeping the secret from society," he said in a scathing voice. "We hope to keep it for ourselves."
"But..."
"Stick around and watch. Mr. Green is making an experiment."
Holden dropped into a chair. No one paid any attention to him, and he finally called Leona over and asked her what was going on. Quickly, and while watching the operations at the laboratory table, Leona brought him up to date, including the atom bombing. Holden blinked.
"I dare say we started something," he said in an awed voice. "I never suspected that every metal would get hard."
Idly, he picked up a cube of metal and hefted it.
"What's this?"
he asked. "One of Jim's samples," Leona told him. "But you shouldn't have moved it. It is supposed to stay in contact with that super-hard temp alloy plate there."
"Sorry,"
said Holden. He dropped the cube of metal on the temp alloy plate again, and then reached over to square it up. As he turned it, one corner scratched the plate below. The sound caused all of them to turn.
"What was that?"
demanded Green. Holden showed him. Then Green picked up the temp alloy plate and scratched it deliberately. He tried the plate against another temp alloy plate and scratched it easily. He tried a sample alloy against the other plate and scratched that.
"Lacking any means of measuring hardness at this level," he explained, "we can arrive at this assumption. This is alloy 17 in this series of tests. 17, in contact with temp alloy, hardens. Temp alloy softens. 17 will scratch hard temp alloy, which will scratch the temp alloy softened by 17.
He tried the bench beneath the samples. It scratched. Even with the end of a pick, it scratched. Then, like a geologist marking a contour map, Jim Green started to plot the spread of softening. Like a widening pool, it spread. Out across the bench it went, spread to the legs, started across the floor.
"Out of here!"
he yelled suddenly.
"But why?" asked Leona.
"Because the ground around the yard is filled with tiny metal scrap," he said, "and I'm still worried about that A-bomb."
From the edge of the 10-mile sterile area, they watched the terrible mushroom cap billow towards the sky. The thundering roar buffeted at them, and the ground shook beneath their feet. Upward went the cloud, to be blown away by winds of the upper air.
"You see," said Jim Green, "the confinement of the explosive was such that only enough plutonium exploded to provide restraining pressure for the rest. Then, when the casing returned to its sensible hardness, that restraining pressure permitted the rest of the explosion."
He turned to Holden and handed him the notebook.
"Here, Gregory," he said, "is the means to make super-hard alloys, and the means to control them. I want no part of it."
Holden smiled.
"The cost-plus rider in the contract can be constructed to include the plant as an expenditure," he said.
Green shook his head.
"I never want to see another alloy as long as I live."
He was wrong. It took 8 months to prove it, because it was 8 months before they could rebuild the Green Metallurgical Laboratory on the plains 10 miles from Ramble, Indiana. End of Quarantine by George O. Smith.